from the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It is USDA Report Day, the 29th day of March, 2018. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll go through the details of this morning's prospective plantings and grain stocks report and talk about the reaction in Chicago with Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Matt Bennett will look at the impact at the home level, the basis contracts, and what's happening across the elevator system in the United States. He's with Channel Seeds, Bennett Consulting out of Windsor, Illinois. And then as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast too, right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media, Public Radio for the farming world. Find us online at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Thursday morning, the United States Department of Agriculture updated the prospective plantings report. It shows that farmers in this nation are expected to plant 88.026 million acres of corn and 88.982 million acres of soybeans. That pushed the markets higher in Chicago as they finished up the trading week. May corn 14 and a quarter higher at 387 and three quarters for their Thursday afternoon closing settlement price. Markets won't open again until Sunday evening. July 396 at a quarter up 14, and December corn at 411 and a half, 14 and a half higher. May soybeans at 1044 and three quarters, finished 26 and three quarters higher. July at 1055 and a half up 26 and three quarters, and November beans at 1047 and three quarters finished 31 and a quarter higher. Soft red winter wheat in Chicago for the July harvest month at 468 and a half up 5 3/4. The nearby May up there at 5 1/2 higher at 451. And hard red July at 486 and a quarter, 6 1/4 higher for the day. The loser in the wheat pit was the spring in the July at 586 and a half, down 11 and a half. And the September also 11 and a half cents lower at $5.94. On Monday evening, do visit with us at the Champaign County Farm Bureau U of I Extension building in Champaign, Illinois for a Will Ag Marketing Panel starting at 7 o'clock. This is free and open to everybody. Our panelists will include Gary Schnitke, Todd Hubbs, and Dean Killian. Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Thursday afternoon. We're now joined by Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas, to go through the numbers from USDA and the reaction in Chicago. Giddy up. Hey, what a surprising day this was for March the 29th, Dan.
Oh, it was. It tells you that the grain trade was spreading fake news for the last couple of weeks, I guess.
Maybe so. So let's go through some of these numbers because they're pretty interesting that came out of USDA. They say the corn at 88 million acres. That's far lower than USDA's Ag Forum number of 90 million. The trade was a bit below that. They averaged about 89 and a half, but to be off by 1.5 million acres is a pretty long shot. Again, this is a survey of farmers across the nation, and I want to say they send out about 80,000 surveys. So this is this number's really pretty surprising.
Yes, and you remember who first talked about that 88 million acres? I think we were talking about that at the beef house here about a month ago.
Yeah, so why do you suppose that it happened? I had some thoughts in the back of my mind about the outlying areas, especially in the West. And you can see this, I think, in some of the maps that USDA released. And they're posted to the website at willact.org. Do you suppose that some of this was driven by the banks and some of it was just the natural return to the rotation, so that there were an awful lot of soybean acres last year that just went back into corn, but and or wheat or someplace else?
Well, it was probably a combination of everything. I think we ended up with a little bit more than 1 million more wheat acres, according to USDA, and I think we ended up with 1 million more cotton acres or so. I've been on the road, so I haven't looked at the total acreage numbers compared to a year ago. But I think, yeah, the financing is number one. The cost of putting in an acre of corn and even an acre of soybeans when you look at return on investment. So I think some of the marginal acres, maybe then that people are maybe thinking that maybe it might not be worth planting them this year. But one thing I do want to caution, I mean, it's been my observation of watching these markets for 45 years or I don't know how long it's been. It's not uncommon for the March numbers to come in on the low side. And the trade always goes, where did all the acres go? And then come June, the acres have a tendency to maybe come in on the high side. And everybody says, where did acres all come from? So it's not uncommon now. But I agree with you on the rotation. People maybe went too heavy on beans last year and they wanted to come back to corn a little bit. But still, I mean, corn acres are down from a year ago. And, of course, the trade missed the corn acres, I think, by 1.5 million. And they missed the bean acres by 2 million. So that was a pretty good miss by the trade. I'm sure there's all kinds of explanations, and we'll maybe find that out as we go down the road. But it really lays the groundwork for corn, if that is halfway in the ballpark, of really bringing down long-term ending stocks levels. Now, but we're talking about a year from September from now. Provided demand stays steady and we don't have any hiccups here or hiccups there. So that is what's going to be bullish the corn market, I think, as the trade visualizes ahead. You can now trace out some balance sheets that begin to take corn carryover inventories below the 2 billion bushel mark and maybe even down to the 1.5 level. And when you start talking about a percent of usage as a carryover, that is a relatively small number. So it really makes the corn market going to be very sensitive to weather conditions as we go forward here. Now, as a rule, late springs or wet springs or planting delays don't really catch until you get into kind of middle May. That's kind of the D-Day when you begin to lose corn acres or people begin to switch into maybe soybeans. But this year might be a little different since we're starting out with such a low number compared to what the trade had penciled in. So if we do get into a wet and cold April and planting doesn't go as smoothly as possible, that'll probably help prop up corn futures. Now, on the other hand, if you look at your grain stocks reports, those numbers all came in above the trade guesses or average estimates. So it does say that we still have adequate supplies of inventory around. We're not going to run out of anything anytime soon, but the trade always looks ahead and it visualizes a declining balance sheet on corn. Now, on soybeans, depending upon how demand plays out, maybe you can't pencil out a big decrease in bean carryout, but at least you're not going to see any rise in bean carryout. And, of course, everything is still dependent upon what kind of weather pattern we have. And then, of course, this acreage mix could change. As we get into actual plantings, that'll be reported at the end of June. But no, today's numbers definitely are bullish. You can see by the trade reaction. And I mean, I think it tells you all of the big acreage advisors that were advising customers to maybe be 50% sold on new crop beans. They're all scrambling today. And that seemed to be kind of common recommendation to be 50% sold on beans. A lot of the grain companies are in the advisory business now, and I think they're all kind of in that 50% range. They're always trying to sell a farmer a contract to get origination because they want to get their hands on that inventory. So farmers, I think, took them up on that a lot. corn. I even heard some advisory services as high as 70% sold on new crop corn. I'm sure they're probably really scratching their head tonight, wanting to know what to do about what they want to do about their shorts. But it really lays the groundwork, at least for a more positive. And I've been saying for some time, and I'll continue to say it, is that the odds of having a seasonal high during the first 3 months of the year after a record crop are very, very skinny. And the odds of having higher highs as we go forward into the growing season are better than they are of making lower lows. So I think today's bean high was actually a new high for the year. So November soybeans made new highs for the year. I think December corn maybe fell short by a half a cent or a penny or so. But I don't think it'll be too long that we'll make new highs for the year on corn, on new crop corn and new crop soybeans. And what's good about it is this report was strong enough that new crop corn and new crop soybeans basically closed unchanged to maybe even a little higher for the month. And that's always scary because we started the month of March at the highs after we had a strong January and February rally. So when you make highs early in the month, that's always scary from a technical perspective because you could end up with a month reversal to the downside. Now you're going to see that probably in old crop corn and old crop soybeans, but you're not going to see that in the new crop months. The new crop months are going to be unchanged to higher for the month. So I think that's, you know, a positive indication that things are at least more supportive today than maybe what they were a couple, 3 weeks ago, Todd.
When we get to next week, we'll ask you about where everything stands. Give it a few days to get yourself all situated with some of the new bullishness and see if you can give us some projections out a bit further. Hey, thanks so much, and we'll talk with you again on Thursday of next week.
Very well, Todd.
That, of course, is Dan Zwicker. He's with Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Tomorrow morning, if you want to visit the Farm Doc Daily website, you can do that right now. And get yourself registered for a webinar that Todd Hubbs and Scott Irwin will do starting at 8 a.m. So you can do that right now, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Or look over on the right-hand side or maybe down at the bottom of the page, depending on what size device you're on, and get yourself registered for a webinar tomorrow morning. Go right through all of these numbers and try to detail what they look like. I was in their office within the last half hour or so. They're hard at work, and that 1.5 billion bushel carryout for corn did come up at that point. In today's agricultural news, we'll start with trade. Iowa soybean growers were in the middle of a trade mission to China last week when President Donald Trump announced his decision to hit Beijing with tariffs and investment restrictions. In meetings with buyers, ranging from state-owned food processing giant Kofco to animal feed companies, there was already, they say, a sense that things could get worse before they get better. Kirk Leeds, who was on the trip and the CEO of the Iowa Soybean Association, says the Chinese buyers will be challenged, at least in the short term, to get the country's entire domestic demand from Brazil and or Argentina, the other two markets that come close to competing with U.S. production. Longer term, though, he says, with some additional acreage in Brazil, there's a lot of acres that could be brought into production. There might be some less concern about getting enough soybeans sourced from South America. China's government policy has always been to try to diversify when it sources soybeans. We'll stay with trade, but switch zones. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer says there is a short window for reaching a NAFTA deal with Canada and Mexico because of the coming elections, but he thinks a deal could be reached soon. Lighthizer also indicates that a final NAFTA deal will include a periodic review of the pact, but it remains unclear how mandatory that process might be. On the northern border, however, Canada is not so certain a NAFTA deal is imminent. Lighthizer's Canadian counterpart appears to be less bullish on the prospects of wrapping up an agreement anytime soon. We have to see exactly what the U.S. means by agreement in principle, says Canada's chief NAFTA negotiator. The U.S. hasn't proposed a framework yet, and he says if we're going to achieve that, we would clearly require some considerable flexibility in the U.S. positions in order to be able to obtain that, as would Mexico. Speaking of which, Mexico is knocking down U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer's latest idea to revamp the automotive rules of origin in the NAFTA agreement. U.S. negotiators are considering putting forward a proposal that would include workers' salaries in the calculation to determine which cars qualify for reduced duties under the agreement. The development, which was first reported by Inside U.S. Trade and confirmed by the Canadian press, has been floated informally over the past week and is aimed at incentivizing car companies to pay wages far higher than the current average rate in Mexico. Let's go back across the globe, this time to Asia, where the CORUS trade agreement, or the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement, has been put in place. However, it does not include agriculture. And that's something that the nation's ag sector has applauded because there won't be changes to those things that have already been put into place. Elsewhere along the Pacific Rim, you may be wondering about Japan and trade with that partner and whether it will do a bilateral with the U.S. to escape steel tariffs and help make up losses the U.S. suffered by pulling out of the TPP trade deal. Well, the American Farm Bureau trade advisor David Samuelson says so far Japan's moved ahead with its own TPP, hoping the U.S. will join later.
So will this imposition of the steel tariffs on them and aluminum tariffs move anything onto direct FTA, or is it going to have any direct linkage to that? I don't know. But it certainly will be part of the discussion. I'm sure that Japan, like other countries, would like to be exempt from these tariffs.
President Trump has ditched the approach of past administrations to use the WTO dispute resolution process in favor of a more bare-knuckled carrot-and-stick strategy. Whether that can still work with China or Japan is the question, but Samuelson says the stakes for U.S. agriculture are big, citing gains in TPP.
Of the $5.5 billion annual trade increases, Japan was about $4.5 billion of that. Certainly the big thing was their a substantial reduction from 38.5% to 9% of their beef tariff. Some of the other TPP countries are going to start, when that's all the new TPP is done, start taking advantage of, and we're not.
The Farm Bureau's Samuelson says Japan is a $12 billion market for U.S. farm goods, but could be a lot bigger. A U.S.-Japan trade deal could accomplish that. And finally today, we'll stay with the livestock industry and explore how Amazon's recent purchase of Whole Foods could create change in the way the meat and poultry industry does business. Rod Bain has more from USDA.
What might Whole Foods' acquisition by Amazon look like to the meat industry and consumers? Jeanette Barnard of Decision Next told an audience at this year's USDA Ag Outlook Forum, Amazon's business model is data-driven and forward-thinking, which could help Whole Foods transform from buying meat from small and niche suppliers.
Whole Foods is now going to need to be sourcing from some more mainstream packers. So when that happens, Amazon, Whole Foods, is going to have greater expectations of those suppliers. Those suppliers are going to have to adapt to a company that's making data-driven decisions, that doesn't just want to take 5 truckloads of meat this week because we always take 5 truckloads of meat.
And in turn, allow mainstream meat suppliers to incorporate Amazon's model when dealing with other customers. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world coming up on Monday evening. Don't forget to join us at the Champaign County Farm Bureau Auditorium. That's the U of I Extension building as well, out on the south side of, or rather west side of town here. It's easy to find on Country Fair Drive. We'll do a WillAg marketing panel with Todd Hubbs and Gary Schnitke from the U of I and Dean Killian from Premier Cooperative starting at 7 o'clock. Go through the numbers that we just got from USDA today and try to lay out some plans for marketing the corn and soybeans for the coming season. Speaking of that, we're now joined by Matt Bennett at Bennett Consulting Channel Seeds out of Windsor, Illinois. Nice surprise you got at 11 o'clock, I think, this morning, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're watching the screen, of course, and trying to transition between that and the news, and screen shows huge gains right off the bat. And so looking for, some of the little tidbits. And of course, 88 million acres of corn jumps out at you, but 88.98 on soybeans jumps out. even more. I mean, shoot, you're a million less than any of the estimates. So obviously that was quite a bullish surprise.
Yeah, nice little bullish surprise. Does it change the marketing plan going forward at all?
You know, I think the thing that it does that we try to tell folks, you know, it exacerbates that we're going to need pretty darn good weather. If you don't have good weather this spring, obviously it's not going to take a large amount of weather issue to encourage someone to maybe switch some acres from corn to beans, because you're looking at almost 1050 November beans on the board. And so, yeah, I think that the weather is definitely going to be something that's watched very closely at this point. We didn't even get close to 180, looking at 177 combined acres, you know, cotton acres up, wheat acres up. Some of the things we've talked about recently, I'm a little surprised that we ended up with 177, but it's a really good thing for the U.S. producer for the time being. I just don't want to ignore it. We probably need to be selling into this rally.
Have you done your balance sheets going forward? I know USDA won't show us what they think until we get to the May WASD.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, a carryout, depending on what kind of a yield, you know, if you have a 172 to 174, you know, you're probably going to be able to safely get under 2 billion bushels, depending on where you're going to place demand. But if we hold demand constant, you're certainly looking at needing the type of yield you had last year to even come close to being able to hold together your stock situation. So I do think you probably buy a few acres between now and June. I don't think 88 is going to be where we land at the end of June, unless we just see a really wet spring, because again, it's just not going to take much to switch over.
That, of course, is Matt Bennett of Bennett Consulting, Channel Seeds, from Windsor, Illinois. You're listening to the Closing Market Report for a Thursday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason, now joined by Eric Snodgrass from Agrible to take a look at the weather forecast. We'll begin here in the United States, the Delta region in particular, Eric, where I know they had been running just slightly ahead, in fact, on corn planting, but I'm going to guess that's been stalled. How badly?
Yeah, you know, the amount of rain that's fallen over the last 3 to 4 days, plus the forecast for the next 10 days, there is going to be very, very tiny windows, if even windows exist, to plant in certain places down in the lower Mississippi River Valley. So let's go all the way from eastern Texas through Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, all the way up into Tennessee, Kentucky. That whole area is just, they got flood watches out right now. There are flood warnings in certain places. And as they take in all that water, it's going to take a little bit of time for it to drain. So we're going to have some issues that even once the rain stopped, it's not as though, you know, 2 days later you're going to be able to get in the fields. We're going to be dealing with some saturated soils for some time. And, you know, looking here just at the short-term forecast, getting us out through the next, you know, 8 to 10 days, the models are in pretty strong agreement that things are just going to stay wet down there. So, you know, these guys, they're the first to get in. They want to get in now, and they want to get in fast and get the crop out early. And we're going to push them, you know, if they didn't get a little bit in when it warmed up a little while ago, well, we're pushing them now maybe as much as a 3 week delay, maybe even longer than that. So this is, this may be a mid-April before we see anything shift for them to be able to get into the field.
I always think of them as a lot closer to the Kansas and Texas, Oklahoma area and some of those hard red winter wheat areas than we are. Is there blowback that allows them to get a little rainfall in that area too to help their crop out?
Well, in order to make that happen, we're going to have to see the whole, you know, we call it a wave train. So the trough ridge pattern, we need it to shift about, I don't know, let's call it 500 to 1,000 miles to the west. And if that happens, we get these four corners troughs, and then we could race that drought in Texas and Oklahoma and Kansas in no time at all. Now, the good news is that in the 10-day forecast, we have some pretty good model agreement, both with the European model and the U.S. model and their ensemble members, as bringing, you know, the eastern half of Kansas, the eastern half of Oklahoma, quite a bit of precipitation. And the European model even has precipitation getting all the way across Kansas. That's huge for this wheat crop right now. Now, why are we relying so heavily on the models here is because when I look at their analysis and I see how they've got the jet stream set up, I see what it looks like compared to what the winds are currently doing in the atmosphere. I think they've been well initialized, which is why I'm going to rely heavily on what the models are saying at this point. So this is good news for the wheat producers. This will more than likely, they'll mean that we're going to see improvements in the crop condition. And, you know, that could certainly have, you know, play havoc on the markets this time of year.
Let's jump to the northern plains and the northern Midwest Corn Belt. It looks like it's going to be cold, maybe even wet there, too.
Yeah, we've got a Clipper system coming through over the weekend that's going to dump snow across North Dakota, northern South Dakota, really the middle section of Minnesota. So not really the real productive ground in the southern part of Minnesota, but the middle part of the state, and then over into Wisconsin. So what we're doing is we're just putting more moisture down on top of the soil, which is in some places still frozen. And it's got snow on the ground in North Dakota. So what we're doing with these little Clipper systems is we're just increasing their flood threat as they move into April and May. And of course, that increasing flood threat just means a further and further delay in them getting planted. There's always the threat for big prevent plant acres when we have a lot of snow and when it's cold in April. But it all depends, of course, prevent plant depends on the price of corn at that time and what the insurance has been set up back in February. So we're kind of in a wait and see mode to see what it's going to look like in terms of maybe an increase in acreage that doesn't get planted this year. Talking with a couple of bankers near Fargo, they're anticipating having higher than average prevent plant, but how much of their 7 million acres of soybeans are going to be not put in the ground? That'll be an important thing to watch as we move through the month of April and May.
And finally, any reason to believe that the cool pattern we've been under will break anytime soon?
Not a chance. I am like so depressed by this. I just want to be outside. And, so when I look at it, the whole problem is that the Bering Sea is blocked up. So if we put a bunch of warm air in the Bering Sea, that cold air that it should be there has to get pushed somewhere else. It's going to push to the Hudson Bay. That basically gives us a deeper trough over the Hudson Bay, and that's going to control our weather. So which means we're going to see northwest flow in the atmosphere. We'd love to have that in July, but we don't want it in April. We want a little bit of a ridge. So I'll be watching for ridging to develop probably over Hawaii. If I start to see in the long term a ridge over Hawaii, that is a good signal for us in terms of getting some warmer conditions. There's a hint, I really hesitate in saying this, but there's a hint sometime around the 12th, maybe the 15th of April that we could develop that. But right now it's only showing up in a few of the ensemble members, which means I can't put too much trust in at this point. So tough thing to forecast, but that's what we're watching. Until that happens, it's going to be wet and cool.
Hey, Eric, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Eric Snodgrass is a professor of meteorology here at the University of Illinois and co-founder of Agrible. You can find him most days on the Morning Farm Report. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.